So, I have had the pleasure and honor of introducing Jim Wilson to our Many Rivers audience on many, many occasions over the years. Actually, into other audiences as well, it seems to me, as well. And so, this is a pleasure that has repeated itself in my life. I do not tire of it. And I've known Jim since 1980, which turns out to be practically the Mesolithic period, because neither of us is getting any younger. And he continues to expand and grow, but there is a theme that has been...
Expand.
We all...
In many ways, besides the physical as well, and but there is one topic that he has held in his heart, I think, for a long period of time, and that is the one he will be addressing tonight. So he can speak more eloquently about it than I. I will say no more other than to invite you to join me in welcoming Jim Wilson to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Thank you for coming tonight. It's wonderful to see all of you. I'd like to start with just a few minutes of silent prayer. That's a little experience of renunciation. So when people voluntarily enter into that kind of silence, what they're giving up or renouncing is speech, and speech kind of makes us human, you know, like, and the way we speak defines us as an individual as well. We all have, you know, certain individual characteristics of speech. So just that movement into silence is a kind of enunciation, you know, like, it's a kind of asceticism. Now, asceticism is kind of a scary word, you know, like, we've, because when we think of ascetics, we tend to think of, you know, like somebody in a cave, or do people know about the stylites here? Yes, you know, the stylites who lived their entire life on a platform exposed to the open air. You know, like, there were such people in early Christianity. You know, like, this very, our mind tends to go to these very strenuous examples, you know, like, of asceticism. So one of the things I'd like to communicate today is that we all have an understanding of asceticism and renunciation, and that maybe we can plug into that and use that ability in a way that nourishes us. You know, like, maybe we don't need to be frightened or alienated by that capacity. I'm going to be very conversational. I'm not a great renunciate myself. I'm a renunciate wannabe. I have a great admiration for renunciation and asceticism. You know, like, I've always found it personally very inspiring. You know, and I was a monastic for 6 years, so I have that experience in my life. You know, like, as a Buddhist monk. You know, like, but I live a fairly ordinary life, you know, so I don't want to give the impression that I'm like some sort of experiential authority on renunciation. So, but I'm a great admirer of renunciation, and the talk today, I'm going to touch on a few people who we can look at as renunciates. Then I'm going to talk about what I call ordinary renunciation. And then I'm going to talk about what I call the logic of asceticism. You know, why would some people choose that as their primary means, you know, like, for spiritual cultivation? You know, like, what's the reasoning behind that? What's the foundation? And then types of renunciation. Obstacles to asceticism in today's world. This is a lot to cover, and I may not be able to cover. And then finally, I'd like to talk about the benefits of asceticism. So the connection between asceticism and renunciation is that renunciation is the method, you know, like, and asceticism is kind of the inclination. So it's like, you know, if you're talking about, say, baseball, you know, like, the you have to learn how to swing the bat, you know, like, and renunciation is like learning how to swing the bat, catch the ball, pitch, you know, and run bases, you know, that kind of thing. You know, like, the game of you know, the object is to win the game, you know, like, and so it's that kind of connection. Asceticism is the methods whereby renunciation is embodied. Yeah. Please feel free to ask questions, or if something's unclear, you know, like, here's an example of a modern-day renunciate that is very interesting to me and well-known. On December 10th, 1941, Thomas Merton entered Gethsemane Monastery, right? 3 days after World War II, broke open, like, 3 days. Yep. So Pearl Harbor was December 7th, 1941. Right? And he knew that. I mean, like, who didn't know, right? But in his journals, he even mentions it in passing. You know, like, he had to go to the draft board, for example, in those 3 days, and get excused because he was going on this monastic path. That's a very interesting decision, and it's one which I think contemporary people have a hard time understanding. You know, like, just as, I mean, what could be clearer in a social sense than American response to that situation? You know, like, and yet Merton chose to withdraw, enter a monastery. Gethsemane at that time, so, the Trappist order is one of the more rigorous orders of the Catholic Church. It's not the most rigorous, but among the top three, I guess. And it was much more rigorous at that time, you know, like in terms of like sleeping on either platforms or straw, you know, like that kind of thing, you know, like those kinds of practices, you know, like he caught a severe cold the first week he was there because there was not much heat. You know, like this is Kentucky, and winters, you know, winters in Kentucky can get quite cold. So, you know, why would somebody do that? Why would somebody in that particular social situation? I mean, his brother, Merton's brother, Paul, joined the Air Force. Merton and Paul were dual citizens of both Britain and the United States. So Paul went to, he died in the Battle of Britain, you know, like shortly after, you know, like this. And so you have this gesture. To me, it's a very, you know, good archetypal example of a person who is pulled and drawn to that way of life. You know, like, so that even given those social circumstances, he was so drawn to it and so strongly motivated to it that he entered the monastery. Merton, everyone knows about him because he became, you know, this famous writer. You know, like, and he seems to get more and more famous each passing year. But his idea was that he would stop writing when he entered the monastery. He did not have the idea that he would go to the monastery and become a famous writer. He had gained a very minor literary reputation when he was at Columbia. He was the editor of I can't remember, some literary magazines, that kind of thing. He had knew a lot of people, and he could have made a literary career. You know, like, he was placed to do that. So he also gave that up. It was his abbot who ordered him to write. You know, like, and so under the vow of obedience, he did that. You know, like, which is interesting. You know, like, and he did achieve fame as a writer. But psychologically, I think it's important for us to understand that his idea in his heart was that he would cease engaging in the world of literary endeavors, you know, like, and that he would become a monastic. There are many stories that are similar to this. Mahavira, who is the great teacher in the Jain tradition, the Jain tradition isn't very well known. People, who does not know about the Jains? Yeah. They are an Indian tradition, and Mahavira was a contemporary of the Buddha, an older contemporary, maybe 12 or 15 years older, something like that. And the Jain tradition already existed in India, but Mahavira was an extremely important teacher in that tradition. And he gave up a princely life, like, and became a renunciate, and a wandering ascetic, to the point where he gave up even being clothed, you know, like, and he's had this, you know, among the Jains in India, you know, he is the example that they all strive to emulate. You know, like, he was the one who is primarily responsible for dropping the idea of vegetarianism, you know, like, into Indian culture, you know, like. So I bring up the Jains because more than any other spiritual tradition, they have a consistent ascetic view. You know, like they actually equate spirituality with asceticism. You know, like, so the Jain path is a path of renunciation. You know, like, and they've maintained that commitment throughout their history. It's also one of the reasons why they've remained such a small little group. There are many other examples. The Desert Fathers the Desert Fathers are an interesting example because, according to the historians I've read, you had Christianity was accepted as a legitimate religion in the 4th century, I think. Is that right? Yeah. And under Constantine. It took a little while to become the state religion, but it was accepted as a legitimate religion. And Constantine was promoted Christianity, and all of a sudden it became very useful to be a Christian. And the churches were flooded with people who, you know, saw the potential of conversion, you know, like in terms of the bureaucracy and that kind of thing. One of the reasons the Desert Fathers fled into the desert, and they use that word, you know, they use that word, fleeing into the desert, is because they felt they could no longer practice with integrity in this social context, you know, like, and they wanted to replicate by going, you know, by fleeing this context, they wanted to replicate the commitment, you know, like the sense of commitment that had previously been very much a part of what it meant to be a Christian when it was not socially advisable. So this is where we get a lot of stories of extreme asceticism, but my favorite of the Desert Fathers is Saint Anthony, you know, like, and he's the most famous one, I think. He's the most famous one. But there's a biography of Saint Anthony, but I like his character. You know, I would have liked to have met him. You know, like he's so he became, you know, he would go into the desert as a young man. Maybe he was like 16 or 18, something like that. His parents died. They had land. This is in Egypt. And he went to a church. They were Christians, and he went to the church, and the preacher said to sell you all your things and give your money to the poor. And so he said, "Oh, okay, I will do that." You know, like, he didn't do it right away. He had a sister, so he felt responsible to his sister, and he placed his sister under the care of we would call it a nunnery. I'm not sure what they called it at the time. You know, like a group of women practitioners. You know, like. And then he gave everything to the poor and went off into the desert. You know, like, there were many others already there in the desert. You know, like. But what's interesting to me when I read about this is that the sense that all those Desert Fathers were figuring out their path. You know, like, at that time, there wasn't a set formula. There wasn't a set discipline or rule. They were really searching, you know. So you get all these things about, you know, like, someone comes to the desert and they seek an elder and they say, you know, give me a word, meaning help me, you know, like. And the Desert Father will say, well, try this. You know, like. But what they're saying is, you know, try this, that worked for me, you know, like, and then they come back and say, oh, well, that didn't work, so try this, you know, like, and that's very much what you get in the biography of Anthony, you know, that he got a reputation for holiness over time, people were attracted to him, so he got out of there and went deeper into the desert. I think this happened two or three times in his life, where he had to, he would attract people. And that's one of the things I want to point out about ascetics, is people find them very attractive. In most of history, people are really, really drawn to them, which I think is interesting. It's a question. What is it that the Buddha was an ascetic, and he was a very successful teacher. He attracted many, many, many people during his lifetime. The Desert Fathers attracted a lot of people. Anthony wasn't the only one who had to pack up and go further into the desert. Incidentally, these people earned their own living. Anthony earned his living by weaving, and then having an assistant or an attendant would take them to the market and sell them. And so that's how he generated the minimal income that he needed. And also the humility of the Desert Fathers is something that I find very inspiring. So there's a story about Anthony where this deacon comes. And he isn't coming to seek a word from Anthony. He's coming to tell Anthony about what the correct interpretation of a certain book in the Bible is. And so Anthony sits down and listens, and the deacon goes on, explains things to him, and Anthony is very grateful for him being there. And then they share a very modest meal, and that was the end of that. I find Anthony very attractive, And of course, there's Saint Francis and Saint Clare, both of Assisi. Both of them were, Francis was probably upper class, Clare was probably upper middle class. I believe her father was a baker, but they walked away from that, and they lived lives that, both of them were pretty rigorous about their ascetic practices. They were wanderers. Francis was a wanderer. Claire was a, enclosed. She eventually took a vow of stability and lived an enclosed life.
Julian.
And Julian of Norwich, yes. That would be since... it's not too much later, I guess. I can't remember. My timeline isn't...
She was pretty early.
Julian of Norwich, I believe, was... 14th century. Is that right? Yeah. But she's another famous example. I was at a retreat... at Sky Farm Hermitage, which is a Catholic hermitage, and they gave me this. When I go there, they're hermits, so they give you a hermitage. But their view is that you should be able to do this on your own. They're not there to, guide you. They're not mean about it. Don't misunderstand me. They gave me the hermitage. Each hermitage is dedicated to a saint, and this one they gave me was dedicated to Saint Clare. And I had not been in it before, and going there, and it was quite small, maybe a little more than a third the size of this room, something like that. You open the door, and there's this icon of Clare, just looking a little severe. And she has this book, and the book is open, and on the book is... place your mind before the mirror of eternity. Place your mind before the mirror of eternity, and I knew that I would have a wonderful time. I didn't know it at the time, but she wrote a poem, and that's the first line of her poem. Place your mind before the mirror of eternity. So if you placed your mind before the mirror of eternity, what would you see? What would be reflected back to you? To me, one of the reasons the ascetic does what the ascetic does is because they want to build a bridge to the presence of eternity, and this is the method that they, whereby they can do that. Claire is very clear about this. I mean, that was her focus. That was her intention. And there are many others. I wanted to bring in a few poets. My fave, Emily Dickinson. Exaltation is the going of the landed soul to sea, past the houses, past the headlands, into deep eternity. Bred as we among the mountains, can the sailor understand the divine intoxication of that first league out from land? So I believe that, Emily Dickinson was famous for being a recluse. Over her life, slowly, step by step, she withdrew more and more, and she became more and more reclusive. And when I read her poems, she touches on the theme of eternity very often in her poems. And that's the connection I see between St. Clair, Place Your Mind Before the Mirror of Eternity, and Emily Dickinson. They both had that need to, if they were going to feel that presence, be aware of that presence, then they had to go that route. And then there's a lot of Chinese hermits, hermit poets, hermit monks, nuns. There's a great book there, Road to Heaven, one of my favorite books, by Bill Porter, also known as Red Pine. After the when Deng took over China, Mao had died, and Deng Xiaoping, came to power. He decided to see if there were any hermits left in China, after the fire of the Cultural Revolution. He had studied Chinese hermit poets for a long time, so he knew where to look. And he went there, and he found them still there in the mountain, some of them in caves. And one of my favorite stories is he ran into one elderly hermit, and he said, "Well, how did you survive the Cultural Revolution and Mao's, turmoil?" And he goes, "I've heard of this Mao."
Are you equating hermits with ascetics?
I think, one of the reasons I brought in Emily Dickinson was I think you can be an ascetic and not be an official hermit. But I think that the ascetic impulse often manifests as a call to the hermitage. I think there's a big overlap. There are orders of ascetics. The Buddhist monastic order is an ascetic order. The Jain monastic order is an ascetic order, and they are social orders. They're not hermit, orders. So that would be a counterexample. Those are great stories, and these are great people. But what I'd like to talk about now is what I call ordinary renunciation. So here's an example of ordinary renunciation. I'm not going to go with you to the bar because I have a chem final tomorrow. I have a chemistry final tomorrow, so I'm not going to go to the bar with you. I'm not going to party. So studying instead of partying. How many people have done that? Yes. Yeah. So there you are. Saving instead of spending. I'm not gonna buy that latest CD because I really need to get a new computer. Or a new car. I really love that CD, but it'll be there. So how many have done something like that? So, and then there's dieting. I'm not going to have that piece of cake. I'm not going to, you know, like, have a third helping because I need to take off some weight. You know, like, who hasn't done that? So, you know, my point about bringing these up is that the ascetic is someone who cultivates this frame of mind and makes it a way of life. But it's not something that's alien to us. And I think culturally we moved into a position where the ascetic path looks alien to us. You know, like we don't connect it to our own life. We don't connect it to our ordinary experience. You know, like, and I think we've all had what I call ascetic moments in our lives. So, I mean, what's going on when we say, no, I'm not going to go party with you because I have a chem final tomorrow, so I'm going to study? What's going on is that we are renouncing an immediate sensory experience that is attractive for something else that we value more. Yeah. And that's what asceticism means. That is the method of renunciation. You know, like, I'm not going to participate in this, even though it will feel good, taste good, you know, like, because there's something else that I value more, and participating in this sensory experience will interfere with obtaining that something else. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I have a question, yeah? Comment. You know, Shakyamuni Buddha was considered a great renunciant.
Yes.
At the same time, he went through the, we often call it the asceticism period,
yes,
you know, in which he negated his body,
yes,
and the need for comfort or food. And then he chose the middle way. So I find it interesting that you have so much joined both concepts, asceticism and renunciation.
Uh-huh.
It was interesting how you explained that you were doing it, you know, but it seems like you can be a renunciant and not be an ascetic, what I think an ascetic is. But anyway, it's just a comment.
No, that's fair, and I think many people have in their mind that asceticism only applies to the extreme renunciate. So that when the Buddha went through his period of like starving himself, that then he was an ascetic, you know, like, and when he gave that up, then he became a renunciate. And I understand, and I'm suggesting a different model of looking at that. I think what's happened is at present in our culture, it's very difficult for people to understand why the Desert Fathers did what they did because of this model that asceticism is something extreme, and so we create this chasm between the ascetic and ourselves. But one of the reasons I think that many ascetics are so attractive, why people come to them, is because in those days people recognized within themselves that impulse and they saw it fully embodied in that other person. So it's kind of like we're all musicians, we all sing, we all whistle, you know, like this, that, and the other. But we really, really like going to see people who are really good playing music. You know, we really like to go to a concert. We flock to concerts to hear that performance. In a similar sort of way, I think people are very attracted to renunciants because it resonates something in their own experience. You know, like, you know.
Deep calling of the deep.
Deep calling to the deep. Yeah. Thank you.
There's a quality of renunciation that is a disengagement,
right,
from the world.
Yes.
So you haven't mentioned some, who I consider some of my favorite renunciants, who are deeply engaged in the world, mm-hmm. like Mother Teresa, and get to
Dorothy Day.
Dorothy Day, yeah. Ani Tenzin-Palmo,
right.
Sister Lucy.
Right.
In your, you wouldn't see them as ascetics or renunciates.
No, I would grant that, you know, like I would agree that Tenzin-Palmo, for example, but Tenzin-Palmo is, you know, I mean, she's a classic. Tenzin-Palmo spent 12 years in a cave in the high Himalayas.
Right, yeah. But she decided she needed to come out and help the nuns of Tibet get an education,
right.
and start the schools.
And that's beautiful.
You know, Simone Veil.
Like, Simone Veil. I see is a continuum. You know, like, and I see, to me, Tenzin-Palmo is inspiring because she spent 12 years in the cave. You know, like, the story of her leaving the cave is interesting. India does not encourage foreigners to reside there. You know, you have to renew your residency every single year. You know, like, there's historical reasons for that, but I don't want to go into that story. So Tenzin-Palmo was 12 years in India, in the upper Himalayas, high in the Himalayas, and she didn't renew her paperwork. So there was the Indian bureaucrat knew about Tenzin-Palmo. And it was fine with him. He just sort of stamped it every year. And then he retired, right? And a new guy came. This is after 12 years. And he took the file out, and he actually walked. He walked all the way up to her her cave.
You need more bureaucrats like that.
I know. You know, like, and then he knocks on the side of the cave, you know, yoo-hoo. You know, and she goes, yes. You know, like, and he says, well, you know, you got to leave. You know, like, you haven't renewed your, so she said, okay. You know, like, it's a wonderful story. You know, like, but I mean, the answer to your question is, my feeling is that what has happened today is that renunciation is justified. It's okay in our culture if it's coupled with activism in some way. You know, like, and if it's not coupled with activism, then it's suspicious. You know, like. And I would like to offer a model that gives a different perspective on that. You know, like, so, so asceticism is the method of turning away from an immediate sensory gratification in order to attain or reach some non-sensory goal or ideal. Okay? So, you know, like, I'm not going to go out and party with you, that's sensory gratification, so that I can get a good grade on my chem exam. Now, in a way, that's sensory gratification, but it's much more nebulous than...
it's not immediate.
It's not immediate, and it's a little vague. It's a little harder to define, you know, like, what the reward is there. But I would suggest... What I would like to suggest is the ascetic is someone who has fallen in love with the presence of eternity. Okay. And that's the reward, that's the ultimate that they seek.
That's exactly what I've been looking for. For me it's like there's a wall and time moves on the left side and on the right side. When you get there, you're in the presence of eternity.
Right.
The Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And there are times when I feel so enslaved to my anger and my upsettedness and hatred of what's going on that I don't like in the world.
Right.
And I am walking in darkness. And I have to go sideways in time to the presence of the eternal so that I can reflect, mirror,
right,
and come back and walk in the light of the eternal. And then I feel like a whole person.
Yeah, I get that. Thank you. That's beautifully put. Thank you. So, is it necessary to practice asceticism, renunciation, in order to be in the presence of eternity? And I don't think it is. I think there are many wonderful examples of people who are able to do that without engaging in asceticism. I don't happen to be one of them. And that's one of the reasons why I find the aesthetics so attractive. So, this turning your back on the world is something that modern human beings, modern culture finds very distasteful. You know, like this is like you're forgoing your responsibility, you know, like to other human beings, you know, like when you do that. And so what I want to suggest is I think there really are, in my heart, I really believe there are sages and saints who can maintain that sense of the presence no matter where they are and no matter what they are doing. You know, like, and it is a wonderful ideal, I think, and I wish I could do it. And I am unable to do it. You know, like, so, I mean, what I'm reporting to you is that when I go off to the Hermitage at Sky Farm, I'm closer to God. I'm obviously not, I mean, I don't mean that literally because God is everywhere and God is eternal. And it's just, but I am able to rest in the presence of eternity in a way that is almost palpable. You know, like, and in the comings and goings of the world and the distractions and the this and that and the frictions, I find it very difficult. You know, like, and my suggestion is, you know, I call this ascetic type, you know, like in my talk, you know, being an ascetic type in a sensual world. The ascetic type is someone who is predisposed or constructed or something so that they can access eternity only through renunciation. And that's why they do it. And renunciation is not a requirement. It's not a path that everyone, it's not, this is where I would disagree with the Jains, for example. The Jains, you know, make a direct connection. The more you are renunciant, the more realized you are. And I've met some wonderful sages and saints who are completely in the world all the time. And thank God for them, you know, like, but there are also those who have to follow this other route.
So thank God for them too.
And thank God for them too. Right,
so. Can it be that sainthood is momentary and fleeting? Each one of us experiences moments of it that come and go.
Uh-huh.
Being in love, grabbing somebody, you know, and there are moments when each one of us can remember back to when we have walked in the light.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, Paul is wonderful about this. You know, like he talks about how he sees through a glass darkly. You know, like, and you know, Paul had this experience on the road to Damascus. I mean, he was, you know, like zapped like no one else has been zapped. You know, like it's just like he had this conversion experience, and yet he reports, the good that I would do, I do not. I see through a glass darkly. You know, like, so. So that, I love Paul for being, for that confessional, those confessional passages about his own understanding. His own understanding ebbed and flowed. You know, like, at times he was, seemed very clear, and at other times it was like a mirror with ashes on it, you know, like, or something like that. So my experience is like what you describe. It ebbs and flows. You know, there are moments of great clarity, there are moments of great understanding, and then there are long periods of where that is not the case.
But in reading some of the renunciants, it was true for them too. There were long periods where they were cut off.
Yes, from that's right. The renunciate literature is rich in discussions about what to do during spells of dryness. I think the Latin word is acedia.
Acedia.
Yeah. And it's a very well studied and written about. My favorite work on contemplation, A Guide to True Peace, has a whole chapter on spiritual dryness. You know, like, and what that means, and why it's there, and my own gloss on periods of spiritual dryness is that the transformation that is happening to people isn't primarily in the realm of the mind, small m mind. You know, like, for example, it's not about changing your opinion about the ontological structure of, you know, of this or that. It's not about that. You know, like, there's a transformation that goes on in the organism, which is way, way, way below, much deeper than the level of ideas and emotions. You know, like, and so my feeling about the period of dryness is that the transformation and the understandings are being, are dropping into the organism, you know, like at levels that that the intellect literally cannot access, you know, like, and so the intellect sees that as a period of dryness, you know, like, and our emotions feel it as a period of dryness, you know, like in the Xinxin Ming, you know, like where it says hear feelings. Also cannot guide, you know, he's already discussed the mind and tossed that aside, you know, like, but here feelings also cannot guide, you know, like, so there's, you know, like, so I'm just offering that as a consideration, because how many of people here have gone through periods of spiritual dryness, you know, where you just feel, yeah, if you persevere. And this is hard. You know, this is where a community comes in. You know, it's harder, I think, for a hermit. You know, like, but if you persevere and you come out the other side of that, not right away. This is I'm reporting my experience. Not right away, but down the road, I go, oh, that's what was going on. You know, like, so that's what was being worked on. That's, you know, like, that's different. You know, like, so I just offer that to you as a...
And the next time you go through a period of silence, of dryness, you remember,
right.
Yeah. That you got through it.
Right. So...
Is that kind of like the dark night of the soul?
Yes, dark night of the soul, yeah. So, I'd like to talk a little bit about the specifics of renunciation. So you can, there's renunciation of the body, and one of the most pervasive is fasting. So, how many people have fasted? Yeah. So, fasting is a really wonderful spiritual practice, because we are very attached to eating. I am very attached. And you know, and it brings all that up. You know, like all of that, you know, like very basic mammalian stuff, you know, like comes up. You know, like it's really, I think that's why you see it across many, many, many different traditions. You know, like,
But actually, in indigenous cultures, fasting is actually a way to change your consciousness.
Yes, right. Particularly extended periods of fasting. Yeah.
To change your what?
Consciousness.
Consciousness, yeah. So there's renunciation of speech. So when I was a Buddhist monk, I did a study of the Vinaya. The Vinaya is the code of conduct which governs Buddhist monastic life. It is 6 volumes long. It's not just a little, you know, like a 50-page thing like the Rule of Benedict, you know. there's a summary of the Vinaya. It's called the Patimokkha, in which all the rules are listed. There are about, I think there are about 200 of them, if I remember correctly. Yeah. 250, something like that.
340 for women, and maybe it's...
There's more for women than there are for men, yes. And and what I did is I took the Noble Eightfold Path and I tried to assign each rule of the Patimokkha to the path, you know, like so. And one of the, which was very helpful to me, you know, like, and that's the kind of, I have that kind of mind. So one of the things I discovered is the overwhelming majority of the rules in the Patimokkha are about right speech. So like, isn't that interesting? Like, a majority of them are about right speech. You know, like about not gossiping, not backbiting, not, you know, speaking this way and not that way. And there's all these codes of conduct about right speech. And it really hit me. Oh, that's why the Buddha had that on the Eightfold Path. That's why he had right speech there. You know, right... You know, he has right meditation, which Americans really take to. You know, right meditation, that's cool. You know, like,
you get the right speech.
The right speech, not so much. but you know, like Jesus, at one point when he was when they were discussing diet, and he said, you know, the rules of diet, you know, like, we are not made evil by what we put into our mouths, but what comes out of our mouths. That creates, you know, that creates problems. And he lists the problems, murder and, you know, like a, you know, like all sorts of bad things. It's an ugly little list. And, and I mean, it's interesting that he had that perspective, you know, like the, what comes out of our mouth is, you know, can be very, very destructive. For a while, I went through a discipline. I actually... heard about this from Jack Kornfield. I wasn't a student of Jack Kornfield, but I heard about it from him. And it was to not speak about anyone not physically present.
Yeah.
My teacher, Sun Sneem, once got very annoyed at me, and he told me to go on silence. He was really annoyed. Because as a young monk, we would have these meetings, and I would have a suggestion about everything. because, you know, there'd be like a problem, like who's going to do the laundry, and I would say, well, the way we solve that is, you know, like, and who's going to wash the dishes? Well, the way we should do that is, you know, like, that was me. Can't you see me? And so he turned to me, and he goes, Mujin, no more talk. So I did, you know, because I trusted him, you know, like, and he asked me to do it, so I did it. So that was 27 days.
Did you have a chalkboard?
No chalkboard. And no hand signals. So it was a wonderful experience. It really was. Because it, so I would go to the meeting, which was weekly, and I could see the mind that wanted to, you know, I could see the mind that wanted to raise its hand and settle things, you know, like about, and I was stunned. Everybody found a solution that I hadn't thought of. What's with that? It was very humbling. Yeah, it was really good. You know, like, so I'm just relating. There are many in lay life. It's harder to practice these rules about right speech, but you can do it. Not talking about someone not physically present, every once in a while I renew that. You know, like, it's a hard one to do, like, at work. You know, like, because if your boss asks you, you know, like, about so-and-so, it's, you know, and then you say to your boss, well, you know, I'm on a spiritual discipline now, and I don't, I'm not talking about people who are not physically present, you know. Unless you have a very understanding boss, it's not going to go very far. But I still offer it for you. You can do it, like, on a weekend. You know, a couple of days of it, you know, something like that. You know, like, so it's a very good practice. You know.
Yeah, I do that practice from what you taught me years ago, and I do it from time to time, and it's not always possible because sometimes you have to, like, especially if you have a job or whatever,
right.
You have to talk about others not present, but what it does is it makes you very aware of your intention and what the nature of what you're saying about the person,
right.
And it cuts gossip and juicy stuff to the quick.
It really does.
Exactly.
Yeah, it really, you know, why do you want to talk about somebody who's not physically present?
Yeah.
It's usually because you don't want to speak well of them.
One of the things that I find helpful, and I think, I'm not sure in Buddhist practice, but four gates of speech, is it necessary? Is it kind? Uh-huh. Is it timely? Is it beneficial?
Right.
Stop and think about those things before I open my mouth.
That's a wonderful practice.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful discourse of the Buddha's, I can't remember who he was speaking to. He was speaking to a group, and he was talking about right speech, and he said, it is not sufficient for speech to be truthful. Right? It must also be helpful. It has to be both. You know, like, if it is truthful but not helpful, then you should, you know, think of something else, some other approach, you know, something different, or you should simply let it go. I mean, you know, so.
No brutally honest here.
No brutal honesty, right? So. And then there's renunciation of the mind, which we started out with silence. Right? Silence is one of the great tools for renunciation of the mind. You know, like silence, stillness, stability. You know, like many renunciates practice stability. Tenzin Palmo, 12 years in your cave in the snow. You know, like.
And what did she say? She said that was easy.
Yes.
Compared to what she had to do to be of service in
right,
the world.
Right. Right. Yeah. And Yeah. You know, I met her once. She was remarkable. She would, she was, when you spoke to her, she was totally attentive to you. There was nothing else on her mind than what you were saying. And then when you were done speaking, she was on to something else completely. You know, like, it was unnerving for some people. It was really unnerving for some people. You know, like, that it, you know, like, but her capacity for being attentive and being totally present was extraordinary, or is extraordinary. Yeah. So, and then there's social renunciation, and that's solitude. You know, like, and this is where, in the classic literature about asceticism, you get the conflict between the world and the ascetic. You know, so there I described Anthony. He's going off to the desert. You know, like, well, why didn't he get, you know, an apartment in Alexandria? You know? because the ascetic type, the social interaction creates a kind of cloud for the ascetic type and makes it difficult for them to access this presence. Now maybe that, you know, you could view that as a kind of a flaw. You know, like, if you are from the perspective of that social interaction is that ultimately, you know, you should re-enter the world and come back to the marketplace and that sort of thing. But I would like I have a mystical view of it. In some ways, I don't like to use that word because it means so many different things to different people. But I can't think of a better word. I really believe that the renunciates who are in their caves or wherever they are, you know, like, are benefiting the world by what they're doing. You know, like, and that their presence and their serenity and their connection to that divine presence resonates through the world. You know, that they are a blessing presence, you know, simply by what they are doing. You know, like, and I know that that's hard to explain, and I'm probably not doing a very good job, but that's what I feel in my heart. You know, like that the presence of those kinds of people in the world is transformative to the world in a very profound way.
I want to, that makes a bell go off in me with a comment that I've been sitting with for a while. It seems really, on one level, helpful. I'm finding myself very in love with the presentation tonight from a certain view, because it seems that one of the things that's present in the world today is an attitude that we need to rush in and fix things.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that stepping back has great value in terms of, like, not doing anything first, at least, and being sensitive to and present to what's actually happening instead of hoisting. I think maybe sometimes what happens with social agendas is people get very heated up and think, we have to do this now and we have to make it better. And that sometimes, mm-hmm. if not oftentimes, seems to me to screw things up further.
Mm-hmm.
So
I've noticed that in my own life.
Yeah, it seems of great value.
So I have a question for the renunciant types and the ascetic types of group.
Mm-hmm.
Are there containers left in the world now and in the future for them?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure. You know, Anthony could. Are there containers for the renunciate type to live their ascetic life? You know, like, for example, Anthony could go off to the desert, and the desert was unclaimed. You know, like, the county clerk didn't come up and tell them, like, the clerk for Tenzin Palmo. You know, like, in the Russian Orthodox tradition, they wandered off into the forest, you know, like, and you could not do that today, you know, like, there literally is no place you could go where you could do that, and yet I do think it's possible. I do. It will take some adjustment, you know, it will take some conscious work, you know, like, there's a woman by the name of Sarah Maitland. I didn't get her book out, I should have, but she's written a book on silence, you know, like, and she, after a life very involved in politics, and she's British, she became drawn to silence. She's an Anglican, and she the value of the book is she really had to work hard to figure out how to find, you know, this kind of situation. And a lot of the book is her trying this route and trying that route, you know, and trying this situation, it's not quite working out, you know, and trying. She had support from close relatives and some friends who valued her search, so she was lucky that way, you know, like, but, I mean, eventually she found a house in a remoter part of England, so I can't remember the region of England, you know, and that's where she ended up. But part of the value of her book is in that search and this testing. You know, like, Alice Kohler is another example. I'm not sure she's still alive. If she is, she's in her late 90s, but a couple of decades ago she wrote a book called Stations of Solitude. You know, like, and she's not religious. You know, like, she was the first woman to receive PhD in philosophy from Yale. So, she's secular and an avowed atheist, but she was drawn to solitude. And it was hard. It was, you know, like balancing, you know, like she had to earn her own livelihood. So, you know, Anthony earned his livelihood by weaving, you know, like, so Alice Kohler earned her life by doing temp work, you know, like, and, you know, balancing the needs of solitude with the need to earn your own living. She's very good about that, you know, she's very good about exploring that. And I think that there's another, you know, century of testing about this. You know, what form will it take? The older forms of hermit life and asceticism don't seem to, there doesn't seem to be a space for theirs. I mean, Sky Farm is a hermitage. You know, maybe that's an example. You know, it's small. So I think it's very much up in the air how that will manifest in the world, you know, or even if. I want to talk a little bit about obstacles to asceticism in today's world, and one of them is a tendency to psychologize the ascetic impulse or the renunciate impulse, to turn it into a neurosis. You know, I remember talking to someone about Emily Dickinson, and I can't remember the word they used. I'm sorry, I should have written it down, but it slips my mind. And they said, oh, she's an agoraphobic, or, you know, like, or something like that. Well, actually, she wasn't. She had very good relationships with the children in, what was the town she lived in? I can't remember.
Amherst.
You know, like, she baked for them, you know, like, in the morning. Almost every morning she would bake, you know, like, goodies for the kids in the neighborhood. You know, like, so it wasn't that she was, disgusted with humanity, you know, like, or, you know, or felt, you know, like, repulsed by, you know, like, people, you know, like, but she had a need for that solitude. You know, in order to write her poetry, she had to have extended periods of solitude, you know, and she, and so this tendency to look on that is reinforced by the examples that the press gives of, like, the Unabomber, something like that. You know, like they become our archetype of what it means to be solitary. You know, like, and of course, you know, who wants to do that? You know, like, so, and it creates a kind of suspicion. You know, something must be wrong. You know, something must be dysfunctional. You know, for someone to do that. You know, like.
So would there be a difference between, you know, a solitude and a loner?
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
The loner is where you think of that crazy person.
When I was the abbot of a Buddhist temple, and people would ask me about being a hermit or something like that, I had five criteria that they should look into. And the fifth one was intention. They must become clear about their intention. If they were motivated out of human beings are disgusting, and I hate them, and I despise them, and I don't want any of them near me. You know, like, that intention will grow in solitude and create a very sour, bitter life. You know, like, so you need to examine that intention. You know, if your intention, it's interesting, in Maximus the Confessor, he was a desert father, or he wrote at the time of the Desert Fathers, and he, there is a work he wrote called, which is an ascetical work. It's a famous ascetical work. It's part of the Philokalia, and 400 verses on asceticism. But what he titled it was 400 verses on love. And you'll see both titles. You know, like, and that. That his description of asceticism is that it's a manifestation of love, you know, love for people, and primarily love for God, you know, like, and for all people through God, you know, like. To me, that's a wonderful example, you know, like, of he had become very clear about his intention, you know, like, I mean, he had written extensively about it, But it really is possible. If you, I mean, Dostoevsky and the Brothers Karamazov, there's Father Zosima, who's kind of a hermit, and everybody likes him, and he's, you know, just, you know, very, very attractive. People come to him, you know, like, and he's humorous and filled with light. And then there's this other guy whose name, of course, I can't remember, who's just this nasty, bitter, dried-up hermit who's, you know, just, you know, like, has, you know, clearly gone on the wrong path in his life. So, another obstacle is materialism and secularism. So if you are turning away from the world, or, if you do not believe there is such a thing as the eternal, then asceticism makes no sense. Well, if you, you know, like, if you do not believe that there is some kind of transcendence, you know, like, then you're just wasting your time. You know, like, you're fooling yourself. You know, like, so, and that's a very widespread view in the world today. You know, like, that view.
Help. Help. Do I need to believe in a spiritual otherness, a God, in order to settle myself in the silence and in my mind's eye see that great dream of the People's Republic of Light, Kingdom of God, but that impossible dream where the city where people are good, they're nice, there's love, there's enough food, there's the gates are open wide because ain't nobody gonna come steal nothing. I can access that dream which I think has been placed in the mind, heart of every soul that's ever walked this planet. And it will be here after our civilization collapses.
Yeah. Beautifully put. I don't know whether you have to believe in a transcendental reality. What I think, and this is fluid, what I think is that if you only believe that the world of sensory experience is real, then that is an obstacle. If you believe there is nothing beyond the experience of the senses, then I think you have a problem. The difficulty, and many people have that view, you know, like, the difficulty with that view is that every single day you use realities in a very practical way that are beyond the experience of the senses. I mean, if you use the word and, or in between, or any of those common words, I'm not talking about mystical things, I'm talking about perfectly ordinary things, you know, like, if you say triangle, like, you are entering, you are taking a step into a world that is not exclusively a world of sensory experience. You know, like, I could be wrong about this, you know, but I'm offering this as a suggestion, as a consideration. Another obstacle is what I call lack of guidance. It's hard to find someone who is a good guide or even a good friend on the path of renunciation in the world today, because it's very alien from our culture, you know, like, and so if you feel pulled in that direction and you start looking around for someone to offer you suggestions or guidance, you know, which makes sense. You know, like, it makes sense that you would do that. I mean, should I do this first? Should I do that first? Should I, you know, try this? Should I try that? I'm talking about, like, having a coach. You know, like, if you try and learn a musical instrument on your own, you can do it. It is possible. But if you have a good instructor, it goes much quicker. You know, like, and there just are not a lot of experienced renunciants who are also in a position to offer guidance. And so, apropos your question, I think that's part of the testing. Like Sarah Maiden, she couldn't find a guide when she was drawn to silence. You know, I mean, she read the historical literature, but I'm talking about a living guide. You know, like, and so she had to work it out. That may not be a bad thing. I mean, it may be what's necessary at this time, but it is an obstacle for people.
Whereas, for instance, you would say that Thomas Merton did find a God
right.
within that community.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And would that still be possible today?
I think it's possible.
In a monastery or in some...
Yes, I think you can go to a Trappist monastery, and I became a Buddhist monk, you know, like, so those things are available, but more and more people are feeling alienated from the traditional religious structures, you see. And so, and there's good reason, you know, like, I'm not condemning that, there's good reason why they have those feelings, you know, like, and so there's a sense of distrust about traditional religious structures, and so how do you, you know, like, Sarah Maitland, I suppose she could have joined an Anglican order, but that actually never comes up in her book. You know, like, she never raises that possibility, which I hadn't thought of until your question. You know, like, so, but I think that's part of the temper of the time, you know, that she didn't think along those lines. You know, like, and I see we're coming to a close, so I'd just like to briefly touch on what I think of as the benefits of asceticism.
The good news,
right. So, the ascetic impulse allows you to live within your means. That's difficult for people to do these days. And the reason it's difficult is because we're being constantly bombarded to, you know, like, acquire things. You know, like, so tapping into the renunciation, asceticism, makes it easier to live within one's means. You know, like, asceticism is healthy for the mind and the body. You know, like, many of the ascetics lived very long lives. Anthony lived about 103, 106, something like that. You know, like, I mean, not all of them, of course, but when Bill Porter goes to China and he meets his monks, you know, like, some of them been in those hills for decades, you know, like, and you know, the Cultural Revolution came and went, you know, like, while they were, you know, up there. So there is. I believe, you know, I haven't quantified this, and so I don't have data, but for your consideration, I think there are health benefits to asceticism. And a simple life, a life of renunciation, it assists in the settling of the mind. All right. So outward simplicity assists in inward simplicity. All right. And asceticism is a very wonderful thing for those of us who are in the latter part of life. It's a natural. To me, I'd like to offer this for consideration. In India, there's four stages of life, you know, like, and I can't remember them already.
It's student, householder, forest dweller, and renunciate.
And so at the end of your life, there's actually a role in this classic, you know, like, so, you know, you mature into renunciation, you know, like, there's a description I read about the life of a Jain family, and grandfather was upstairs in their room doing his meditation, you know, like, and everybody knew that at his age, that's a completely natural thing to do, and I think that's wonderful. You know, like, today the pressure on older people, mature people, is to be as active and as vital as someone who's in their 20s or their 30s. You know, like, it doesn't work. It's just, you know, like, it's it doesn't happen, you know, like. And so as an ideal for the later stage of life, I think it has much to recommend it, you know, like. And finally, it trains you to die well. Yeah. And Socrates said that the purpose of philosophy is to learn how to die well. You know, like, and in some ways, I think that is one of the functions of religion. If you walk on a bridge of light into the presence of eternity, then that understanding and that realization offers comfort and some equanimity, you know, like in the present, when we reach that time. A renunciate learns to let go. That's what renunciation is. You know, I'm going to forgo this experience for something greater, you know, like. When we pass away, that is a great letting go. You know, like everything must be let go. You have no choice. You know, like so, if you have the experience throughout your life of how to do that, then you can enter smoothly into that presence. You know, like that we are all bound for, and I think that that's a wonderful gift that. That this understanding has to offer. So, thank you very much. We appreciate it.